Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. Next Tuesday, Virginians go to the polls to elect a new governor. The choice is between Terry McAuliffe, a veteran Democratic insider and a former governor who wants his old job back.
If you remember in 2013, when I took office, our economy was in crisis, chaos. I rolled up my sleeves. We got to work making life better for all Virginians.
And Glenn Youngkin, a Republican businessman who walks a fine line between appealing to Donald Trump supporters while distancing himself from the former president. He hopes to carry an increasingly blue state, which Joe Biden won by 10 points in 2020.
We have a moment here, a defining moment, where we all get to change the trajectory of this great Commonwealth of Virginia. Not just for Virginians, not just for those that live here, for the entire United States of America.
That's right.
Everybody's watching us.
Races for governor of Virginia almost always attract national attention, but that's especially true this year. Polls suggest the race is close. Outside money has poured in, as have big-time endorsements.
Glenn Youngkin is a great gentleman, truly successful. He loves the state. We've got to get him in.
Show up for democracy, for Virginia, for the United States of America. God bless you all, and may God protect our troops. Vote!
This hour, Virginia's race for governor, why it matters so much, and what it says about where the country is headed. Joining us now is Bob Holdsworth. He's managing partner of the public policy consulting firm Decide Smart. He's also founding director of the Center for Public Policy and the L. Douglas Wilder School of Government and Public Affairs at Virginia Commonwealth University. Bob, welcome to On Point. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Glad to be with you, Anthony.
I've been really looking forward to this conversation. Let's start with a really basic question. Why is this race so important? And what might it tell us about the current political mood, not just in Virginia, but beyond as well?
I think a lot of people look at this race as the first election of 2022 in many ways. And what seems to be critically important for a lot of folks outside of Virginia is to think about how a state where Joe Biden won by 10 points could move potentially in a Republican direction if all of a sudden Glenn Youngkin is able to win. And secondarily, or related to that, is that Youngkin has not campaigned by absolutely distancing himself from Donald Trump. He's basically walked what a lot of people are calling a Trump tightrope. He's made a number of direct appeals to Trump-based voters with issues such as election integrity. He said he's pro-life on abortion. And at the same time, he's trying to win suburban defections from the Democrats among independents and maybe even among some people who consider themselves moderate Democrats, by emphasizing some culture war issues, particularly a new one about education, suggesting that the Democrats are trying to control education with big government and aren't enabling parents to have as much influence as they should have on the educational system. But if Youngkin is able to pull off a win in a state Joe Biden carried by 10 points, and at the same time sort of making an appeal that transcends the rural Trump base with highly educated suburbanites, that would be seen as a new model for the Republican Party going forward.
Really interesting. I mean, the history here is fascinating as well, because I'm reading a piece on NPR.org. Democrats have had a lot of success in Virginia over the past two decades. They've won the state in four consecutive presidential elections and in four of the last five gubernatorial elections. They've won every single statewide race since 2009. And 2019, they wrested control of the state legislature after decades of Republican rule. Given that, why is this race even this close?
Well, I think there are a couple of reasons for that. The first is that if we take a look at this recent history, what we saw is that the Democrats were winning these elections from 2005 through about 2016. They won most of those elections, but a number of them were tight. Terry McAuliffe, when he ran in 2013, won election by less than 3 points. Mark Warner the following year was reelected to the Senate by less than 1 point. Then Donald Trump came in, and all of a sudden, Virginians who were very much opposed to Donald Trump, the Democrats, they came out in droves. And all of a sudden, races that were 3 and 4 point races turned into races that were 8 points, 10 points, double digits. Now Trump's out of office. He's not in Washington. He's not on Twitter every 15 minutes. And the Democrats are the incumbent party, both in Washington and in Virginia. So for those people who are frustrated with what is happening or what is not happening nationally, the Democrats have now become the target rather than Donald Trump to some degree. And the other thing that we've seen in these polls that has been pretty consistent, that over the last few months, as President Biden's numbers cratered with independents, that took a toll on Terry McAuliffe's numbers with independents as well. So as we look at this race, Democrats are supporting McAuliffe in large numbers. The question for the Democrats is, are they as enthusiastic about the election as the Republicans? But the real challenge has become the national problem, because as the Democrats do nothing in a state in which we're right next door to Washington and in which much of our economy is related to the federal government, the fact that the Democrats have been in disarray for months now in trying to get some of these bills passed has really taken a toll, I think, on McAuliffe's polling numbers. And the question is whether the Democrats' last-minute push here, in which they have really brought in a lot of heavy hitters to remind their voters what's at stake in this election, will that generate enough enthusiasm and cut through some of the apathy that we've been seeing, at least up until the last month, with the Democratic base?
It's interesting. You touched on a lot of issues there that I want to get to, specifically this idea of how important what's happening in Washington is to this race. But I want to talk a little bit about Terry McAuliffe first, because you gave us a little bit of a portrait of Glenn Youngkin, a businessman, political outsider, first-time candidate who seems to be threading a needle here, appealing to parts of the Trump base while also distancing himself somewhat from the former president. Tell us about Terry McAuliffe, particularly listeners outside of Virginia who might not know that much about him.
Well, Terry McAuliffe came to Virginia as the governor in 2013, where he won election. And at that time, he was seen very cautiously, I think, and somewhat nervously by a lot of Virginians, because he was perceived by and large to have been a political operative, somebody who was head of the Democratic National Committee, someone who was a fundraiser for the Clintons. And the question was, could he actually run the state? He won election in 2013 against a relatively weak Republican candidate and a divided Republican Party. And he won very narrowly in a three-way race. And then as governor, he did quite a good job. He left office relatively popular. And basically, he was perceived as someone who promoted Virginia economic development very successfully. And at the same time, for Democrats and progressives, he was a brick wall on the social issues. Changed some of the state regulations that we had that the Republicans had introduced on abortion, was very clear on giving more felons the right to vote after they had served their time in Virginia, had promoted education reforms, and was generally perceived by the public and by the Democrats to have been an effective governor. But Virginia has this very odd situation where the only state in the country where a governor cannot run for re-election in consecutive terms. They have to sit out. So McAuliffe sat out for 4 years, then decided to come back and had to fight in the Democratic primary against numerous other opponents, including two relatively prominent African-American women candidates. McAuliffe won the primary pretty easily, but at the same time, seems to have had some difficulty, at least up until very recently, in generating a lot of enthusiasm for the candidacy the second time around. Mm-hmm. And maybe because he's perceived a little bit as old news, and maybe because the Democrats have just felt pretty complacent that Virginia was their state right now. And so what we've seen in the last couple of weeks is McAuliffe has brought in folks like Stacey Abrams, Barack Obama, President Biden, Kamala, Vice President Harris, to really try to raise the level of noise and convince the Democrats what's at stake.
But right. And as Youngkin, sorry to jump on you there, Bob, but and as Youngkin is trying to distance himself from former President Trump, McAuliffe is really trying to tie Youngkin to Trump, right? So how's he doing that?
Well, that's been the essence of the campaign for McAuliffe, is to equate Youngkin and Trump, basically to say they're one and the same. As President Biden said, McAuliffe is trying to suggest that Youngkin is Trump with a smile and a fleece vest as he goes around the state wearing that. And, you know, largely he's saying, you know, if you take a look at the Republican Party, both in Virginia and nationally, it is the Trump party. It cares about issues like election integrity. It is interested in removing a woman's right to choose on abortion. Of late, the Democrats have been saying that the Parents Matter theme that seems to have been working in education for Youngkin is really just a cover and a disguise for banning books like Toni Morrison, the Pulitzer Prize winner's beloved book, which has now become an issue here in Virginia. And so largely he is saying that the Virginians shouldn't be fooled by Youngkin, that despite the fact that he positions himself as somebody who is not sort of a full Trump, essentially the issues that he's going to endorse and the party that he's connected to is the Trump party.
Right. Bob Holdsworth, hold on. We're coming up against a break. When we come back, we're going to dive in a lot more deeply into the issues that are animating this race. We're talking about Virginia's upcoming gubernatorial election. The vote is this coming Tuesday. And what it might tell us about the current political moment in America. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking about Virginia's race for governor between Republican Glenn Youngkin and Democrat Terry McAuliffe. Why it matters so much, what it says about where the country's headed. With me is Bob Holdsworth. He's a longtime political analyst who's managing partner of the public policy consulting firm Decide Smart. And joining us now is Mel Leonor. She's Virginia politics reporter for the Richmond Times-Dispatch. And Mel, welcome to the show. Great to have you.
Hey, Anthony. Glad to be here.
So you've been on the campaign trail. Bring us up to date. What's the latest? Where does this race stand right now?
I think as you've seen from a lot of the polls, this race just in the last few weeks has gotten really close. One poll from last week said that both of the candidates were tied at 46%. Another poll from yesterday said, you know, McAuliffe was up by just 1%, really within the margin of error. So just a race that has gotten really close between the Democrat and the Republican in a state that, like Bob said, you know, President Biden won by 10 points.
Right, right. And what are you sensing out there on the campaign trail in terms of, you know, these ineffable qualities that politicians count on? I mean, is there enthusiasm for Glenn Youngkin or Terry McAuliffe? What are you sensing out there?
You know, I've got sort of two comments that I've gotten from voters on kind of either side. I think this one's really telling. I spoke to a woman 2 days ago who came out to a Youngkin campaign event. She was there and, you know, pretty excited to meet the candidate. I asked her about, you know, why do you support him? She said the number one issue for her was education and parents having a role in schools. And then I asked her about but then she said, you know, she's not a traditional Republican or Democrat. She really identifies as an independent. I asked her about, you know, efforts by Democrats to tie Youngkin to former President Donald Trump. And she said, and I'm just going to read the quote because I think it's so good. She said, maybe I missed it, but I don't feel like I would put Youngkin in a category, in the same category as Donald Trump. For starters, I would not be embarrassed of him if he was governor the way I was embarrassed of Donald Trump when he was president.
Interesting.
I think that really speaks to, you know, the effort that the Democrats have made to tie the two candidates. Youngkin certainly has said he is supportive of the former president and would support him again if he ran for president in 2024. But to the extent that Democrats have tried to paint him as, you know, cut from the same cloth, I think that some voters are not have not, you know, believed that message.
So, hold that thought, Mel. I wanted to just bring Bob back. And, you know, Bob, I'm looking at this opinion piece from the Washington Post editorial board that says Glenn Youngkin has failed the test of character. And one of the things they point out that is he indulged and encouraged Republicans who have swallowed former President Donald Trump's lie that last year's presidential election was stolen and that American elections are not to be trusted. Is he still saying that on the campaign trail, or has he come around and admitted that Joe Biden was, you know, is essentially the elected president of the United States?
Oh, Youngkin has certainly admitted that Joe Biden is the elected president of the United States. Mm-hmm. At the same time, what you have in Virginia is a slice of the Republican Party that even today is suggesting that cheating is going on, that one of his, a state senator, Amanda Chase, who is considered herself Trump in heels, as she calls herself, just yesterday warned about all the cheating that's occurring, that the Republicans are deploying poll watchers all around Virginia. And at the end of the day, when you take a look at most of the polling, why Youngkin has to walk this tightrope in Virginia a little differently than maybe a Republican governor would have to in Maryland or Massachusetts, is that his base, in terms of the largest base of support that he has, is the Trump base. It's white, non-college educated voters who are supporting Youngkin by 30, 40, sometimes more in these polls. So Youngkin has to be very, very careful about how he treads. He ultimately needs some of the affluent, highly educated suburbanites who have supported Democrats to choose him. But at the same time, he needs to generate enthusiasm among the Trump base. And I would just say finally on that, this may be one of the most uncovered stories in the election right now. How well is Youngkin doing with the rural voters in Southern and Southwest Virginia who supported Trump? He's going to win them with 75 or 80%. But a key factor may be how do they turn out? And at least in early voting, they haven't turned out very much so far.
Interesting. Yeah, I was looking at those early voting numbers. They seem to be favoring the Democrat at this point. Is that fair, Terry McAuliffe?
I think it's fair, but but I would say that that's also expected.
Yeah.
That the Democrats have had a greater faith in early voting. The Republicans are doing more early voting in the suburbs. There's absolutely no doubt about that. Around Richmond metropolitan area, Virginia Beach and near the coast, and also up in Northern Virginia, the most populous part of the state outside of D.C., Republicans are doing a lot of early voting. However, their strength is really in these rural areas that have not had had as much of a tradition of early voting. And certainly they're not doing that right now. And the question is, are they going to come out in on election day like they came out for Donald Trump the last 4 years?
All right. So there's one of the keys for Glenn Youngkin. Bob, Mel, let's talk about some of the issues that the candidates have been pushing forward. At the forefront, perhaps, as you alluded to, Bob, is education. So during the final gubernatorial debate in late September, Glenn Youngkin challenged Terry McAuliffe about a bill that McAuliffe vetoed in 2016. It would have given parents the right to exempt their children from sexually explicit reading assignments.
I'm not going to let parents come into schools and actually take books out and make their own decision.
You vetoed it.
So, yeah, I stopped the bill that I don't think parents should be telling schools what they should teach.
Now, Youngkin quickly made that the focal point of his campaign.
In the final debate between former Governor Terry McAuliffe and Glenn Youngkin, the topic was education. And Terry went on the attack against parents.
He doesn't think parents should have a say. He said that. He shut us out. Glenn Youngkin, he listens. He understands. Parents matter.
McAuliffe eventually released his own ad, noting his respect for parents.
Glenn Youngkin's taking my words out of context. I've always valued the concerns of parents. It's why, as governor, we scaled back standardized testing, expanded pre-K, and invested $1 billion in public schools. I'm Terry McAuliffe, candidate for governor, and I sponsored this ad because working together, we can give our kids the education they deserve.
So, Mel, give us some background here. This controversy is all about the so-called Beloved Bill, which McAuliffe vetoed twice, actually. Tell us about that.
You know, I think the Youngkin campaign really seized on that debate moment. And, you know, like you said, the banner all of a sudden became Parents Matter. And in other states, I was an education reporter in Florida, we've seen, you know, certain groups of parents like the idea of being able to say, you know, I think this book is inappropriate. It should be removed from schools.
But and this book being Beloved by Toni Morrison, that's why it was called the Beloved Bill, right?
Right. But, you know, there are a number of other books that different groups of parents have riled against, said that they're inappropriate. I think the book controversy, I think for the Youngkin campaign, has really expanded into this kind of broader education agenda that in some ways centers parents, but in a speech 2 weeks ago, Youngkin kind of expanded on it and said, you know, schools are in chaos right now. He suggested that there was violence in schools, and that's why he proposed that every school should have a police officer stationed at it. So I think after the debate, it has really evolved into this kind of broader education platform that goes a little bit, you know, beyond books and parents having the ability to remove books from libraries and school curriculum.
Right. So, Bob, this sounds like a pretty powerful issue for Glenn Youngkin to get hold of. While Terry McAuliffe is trying to tie him to Trump, he's really focusing on this social issue much closer to home.
Yeah, this has been very interesting part of the campaign because he would have expected the Republican really to talk most of the time about taxes and regulation. And now they have this culture war issue that they think unites both suburban voters with the Trump base. The Democrats, at least in my mind, and it's almost inexplicable, were caught flat-footed by this in some ways. It took them weeks to actually respond. And they knew what it was all about because in the last few days, they have really been talking about the fact that Glenn Youngkin and the Republicans want to ban Toni Morrison. They want to ban a book that largely exposed the evils of slavery based on a true story. And it took them weeks and weeks to get to this. And ultimately, what Youngkin has been able to do, I think, relatively successfully, is to take what I would call a culture war issue about the schools, whether it be what, you know, what kind of materials are taught in classes and when parents can opt in or opt out. It's also related to critical race theory that he's raised. It's related to the treatment of transgender students in the schools. And he's made that into a more generic argument where McAuliffe is positioned in his mind, in Youngkin's mind, as siding with big government against parents. Mm. And I think the Democrats had an effective counter to this but it took them weeks and weeks to begin to make that argument. And in the meantime, I think Youngkin made up some ground against McAuliffe.
Right. And what is that argument? And how has McAuliffe been expressing it?
Well, they've now been expressing it by and large saying that, you know, what this is that this has been a conservative activist agenda, bringing what they call the hate and division that we've seen in other culture war issues into K-12 education, into a school system that's generally perceived to be one of the best in the country. And as Mel said, Youngkin is portraying the Virginia schools as a place of tremendous chaos and that is somehow failing and declining. And there's no doubt that Virginia schools, like I think schools everywhere, have had significant problems with virtual education, remote education during the pandemic year. But the idea that Virginia schools are somehow chaotic and failing when by and large, by all indicators, they're one of the best in the nation, is something that is a little surprising to me that the Democrats let them get away with this argument for week upon week.
It's interesting, too, because the power of that argument and, correlation isn't necessarily causation here, but it's an interesting thing to note. I was looking at a Monmouth poll in August and September. McAuliffe had a 5-point lead. Then came that debate, and an October Monmouth poll found the two candidates about tied. So virtually tied, where I gather the race remains today. So, Mel, how is Terry McAuliffe countering this? In other words, what are the big issues that he's focusing on beyond tying Youngkin to Trump that might or might not resonate with Virginia voters?
Sure. And I'll just touch real quick on the schools issue again and the poll that you just mentioned.
Yes, please.
That poll also found that in over the last month, essentially in October, the education became one of the top two issues for voters, bumping COVID-19 to number three. So it found that jobs in the economy were the main thing. And then, soon after Youngkin started talking about Parents Matter and schools, it seemed like all of a sudden education became the number two issue for a lot of people. And so I think we do have a lot of signs that suggest that, Youngkin's message on this has somewhat been successful and changed the dynamic of the race.
Right.
But on Terry McAuliffe, I think he started off his campaign talking about COVID-19, talking about the need for more people to get vaccinated. And I think over the weeks really emphasized that he does support vaccine mandates, both, from the government for state employees, which is something that our current governor has rolled out. And also in workplaces, he thinks that people should be required to be vaccinated. And that's, a way to guarantee that children will be safe and that the economy will rebound after the pandemic. That proved to be pretty successful. A lot of voters do support vaccine mandates here in Virginia. And so I think that that's where he really put a lot of his energy.
And where is Youngkin on that issue?
So he doesn't support mandates. He didn't support a mandate that students should be required to wear masks in schools. And he doesn't think anybody should be required to be vaccinated, and face any consequences for that. At the same time, he's been, pretty clear that he did get vaccinated. He said his family has been vaccinated and he said that everyone should be vaccinated. He just doesn't think that they should be required to. Obviously, McAuliffe has said that position should be disqualifying.
And Bob, I gather that Terry McAuliffe has made abortion rights a key issue as well, which are now under threat in a possible Supreme Court case.
Absolutely. That what McAuliffe has tried to do there is to suggest that when the Supreme Court addresses abortion, both in the Texas case and the Mississippi case, there is now the prospect, and McAuliffe would probably call it the specter, that abortion rights as a part of the Constitution can be overturned. So what McAuliffe has said is that what he would like to do is to enshrine the principles of Roe v. Wade into Virginia law. And Youngkin has said, no, he's pro-life and wouldn't want to do that. Youngkin has said that he wouldn't support a Texas-style law, but has really been very reticent to say what he would actually do. Now, that would depend in part upon the legislature and what happens in the House of Delegates races about what he could do. But it would also be dependent on what he would like to do as governor administratively. And Youngkin would have the opportunity to support members of the to appoint members of the Board of Health. That's a policy-making body that has influence on abortion and also education. And then beyond that, Youngkin has said he would defund Planned Parenthood. So there really is a pretty bright line between Youngkin and McAuliffe on that. And I would just finally add that one of the reasons Youngkin got the nomination, obtained the nomination, is that he very skillfully appealed to evangelicals during the nomination battle. And I think that they will be an important part of his electoral base come next Tuesday.
Really, really interesting. We're coming up against a break, Mel, so I don't have a lot of time for this answer. But this is an off-year election, and it seems like the trick here is really going to be to motivate and get voters to the poll. Just from what you've seen out there on the campaign trail, do you have a sense of sort of where the enthusiasm is most concentrated? Between which of the two candidates?
I think Democrats are definitely, there's a lot that's been said about the enthusiasm gap. I had an acquaintance who, upon seeing yesterday's poll on how close the race was, said, you know, I wish I'd gotten involved earlier. Truly, I still feel pretty burnt out from 2020 and activism there. So I do think that, you know, Biden won here by 10 points, and that I think shows his popularity, but also how how much energy folks are putting into that race. I think Maybe that is not the same enthusiasm now.
All right. We're talking about the Virginia governor's race and what it says about both political parties and where the country's headed. When we come back, we're going to talk about what a Youngkin victory would mean, what a McAuliffe victory would mean. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. Tomorrow on the show, we're focusing on our children and the challenges they face. It's not just the pandemic. It's climate change, racism, politics, social media, and how kids are plunged 24/7 into a toxic brew of negativity. More kids are now overtly pessimistic about their future, and it's hurting them and hurting us all. So we'll hear from people who say it's time to do something about it. As a parent, what's your experience of watching your child grow up in a world with so much uncertainty? Are your kids down on the future or optimistic? Tell us what you're seeing and hearing. And kids, we'd love to hear from you especially. How do you see your future? How are you able to find hope? Tell us your story by giving us a call at 617-353-0683. Again, 617-353-0683. That's tomorrow. Today, we're talking about Virginia's race for governor, why it matters so much, what it says about where the country's headed. We're joined by Bob Holdsworth, longtime political analyst, who's managing partner of the public policy consulting firm Decide Smart, and Mel Leonor. She's also with us. She's a Virginia politics reporter for the Richmond Times-Dispatch. Now, we heard from a couple of On Point listeners about the Virginia race. April Moore from the Shenandoah Valley called to say that Terry McAuliffe has her vote. She says she has big concerns about Glenn Youngkin.
When asked about the climate crisis, the most urgent issue of our time, Youngkin merely shrugged his shoulders and said he didn't know anything about it. And he is already harming our school children by inflaming parents' fears He's telling parents that their kids are in danger at school, and he's egging on those who are harassing and threatening hardworking school board members. He's even called for the ban of some great literature.
We also heard from On Point listener Kevin Blackman from Augusta County, Virginia. He says he's an independent, and he's not convinced that either candidate would be a good choice.
I don't trust Glenn Youngkin with many different things, and I don't trust McAuliffe and the other party to not take away rights given to me in the U.S. Constitution. It's very difficult to find somebody to vote for.
Couple of voices there regarding next Tuesday's election in Virginia for governor. Bob, I want to ask you about some particular voting groups, and let me zero in on black voters, which have put white Democrats over the top in Virginia before. I was reading that McAuliffe in 2013 lost the white vote by 20 points, according to exit polls, but won more than 90% of black voters. That led to a 3-point victory. So I'm wondering how that dynamic is playing out this time around. What's the sense about where the black vote is in this race?
Well, on that dynamic, clearly, I think Terry McAuliffe is going to win the vast majority of African-American voters in Virginia. The question that everyone is thinking about is turnout. How is the turnout going to be? Because he's going to need a large turnout, not simply just a high percentage of voters. And what you've seen over the last few weeks in Virginia is a huge effort directed at trying to escalate the turnout among the Democratic base groups, particularly African-American voters. So Stacey Abrams, Kamala Harris, Joe Biden, Barack Obama, everyone has come to Virginia trying to raise the level of attention that people, particularly Democrats, have on this election and motivate them to get out in the polls. We've seen the Democrats do quite well in the early voting, we think. The numbers are being increased up in the Northern Virginia suburbs. A lot of attention is now being paid to the core vote for the Democratic Party, both in the Richmond metropolitan area and in the area toward the what they call Hampton Roads in Virginia, near Virginia Beach, and the cities in those areas, trying to ensure that the turnout is significant. Because if Terry McAuliffe doesn't get a big turnout, that will certainly benefit Glenn Youngkin.
Interesting. Mel, I'm really interested in this question, and I'll ask you both, but I'll start with you, Mel. To what extent is Terry McAuliffe affected by what's happening in Washington? Because I recall from the years that I lived down there, what happens in Washington really seems to resonate, especially in Northern Virginia, in a big way. So here we've had Democrats really struggling to come to an agreement about a tax and spending bill, about an infrastructure bill. It seems like they're moving. There are signs that they may be getting close to the finish line today, but they're still not there. I'm just curious how this affects Terry McAuliffe's chances, essentially, with Democrats sort of not getting the football across into the end zone in Washington.
Right. Of course, the state, and maybe it's because of geographic proximity, but is just really reactive to what's going on in D.C. You probably know about the Virginia curse, which is that whichever party wins the presidential election, that party tends to lose in the governor's election in Virginia the following year. Of course, Terry McAuliffe was, one of the people that was able to break free from that years ago. And now it's unclear if he'll be able to do that again. He said so himself in a call with supporters that, you know, Biden's dropping popularity is hurting him. And he said, you know, we have to counter that here in Virginia. I would also say that it's ongoing. The president will speak later about the infrastructure plan in Congress. There's reporting that, you know, paid family leave won't be in there. I think we'll see, you know, in the coming days how much Democrats are, you know, disappointed by that and maybe lose some enthusiasm. An analyst I spoke to said, I think a lot of voters will be maybe unmotivated to go to the polls because, you know, they're asking themselves, we put in all this work to remove Trump from office. And, you know, what are we getting in return for that?
Right. Bob, what do you think in terms of how what's going on in Washington is affecting Terry McAuliffe's campaign?
I think it's the single biggest problem that the McAuliffe campaign has had, that McAuliffe was ahead by 7 or 8 points when Joe Biden's popularity was in positive territory. Since Biden has gone underwater, and in particular with independents, there's almost been a direct correlation in the polls with independent support for McAuliffe. So McAuliffe is going to have to win, I think, with Biden's support, at least nationally, being underwater. I don't think it's necessarily going to be that largely underwater in Virginia, though a couple of polls have suggested they are, it is. But this has been a challenge for McAuliffe, and it's a challenge in motivating voters. I'll just tell one little anecdote. I was speaking to a minister of an African-American church the other day, and I asked him, did he feel that his voters, his congregation, was going to come out and vote in large numbers? And he said, I don't know. He said, because I think they're somewhat demoralized because they voted for all these Democrats, he said, and nothing is happening in Washington for them right now. And he said, you know, it's become more of a stretch to convince people to go out and vote when they do vote. And at the end of the day, they don't necessarily see the direct impact. So that's the challenge for McAuliffe. And in my mind, actually is the biggest challenge he faces in this campaign.
Really interesting. So lots of Democrats, I gather a lot more sort of big name Democrats have been pouring into Virginia. Whether it's Joe Biden or First Lady Jill Biden, Kamala Harris was there. Mel, what has been their message? I mean, in terms of trying to ignite enthusiasm behind McAuliffe?
I think they've really tried to follow what the McAuliffe campaign has been trying to do, which is to really tie Youngkin to former President Donald Trump. I think when former President Obama spoke in Richmond, he talked about, you know, Youngkin kind of hiding and not being his true self in terms of some of his views and his support for the former president. I think that that probably has been one of the key points that they've all been trying to make. And then I think they've also tried to rally Democrats on some of the issues that they care about, to put a finer point on Youngkin's views on abortion. He said during a debate that he wouldn't support a Texas-style ban, but he was pretty clear in saying that he would support banning abortions at the point where a fetus can feel pain, which is about, you know, 20 weeks, depending on how you look at that. So I think kind of those two things have been the key emphasis for Democrats here.
Right. And Bob, I mean, I gather this is a sign of alarm for Democrats, with so many of the Democrats pouring into the state and trying to rally enthusiasm behind McAuliffe. What would it mean? What would a McAuliffe loss mean to Democrats and indeed to even to Biden's agenda? What would it mean?
Well, it would certainly, in many ways, increase Republican opposition to Biden's agenda, because they would feel that if they were able to succeed in a state such as Virginia, which has the sixth most highly educated population in the country, has the fourth highest level of people with postgraduate degrees in the country, and that they were able to win with a candidate who found the sort of magic way of both appealing to the Trump base and succeeding adequately or sufficiently in the suburbs, Republicans would think that it's not only Virginia that's going to be trending their way, but it's going to be Georgia. It's going to be Arizona. Just think of these other states where the Democrats won some Senate races by relatively small margin, in which people are up again. Raphael Warnock, Mark Kelly, that the Republicans would really find themselves, I think, extraordinarily empowered by a Glenn Youngkin election in Virginia, because they think it would have impact, particularly in these other swing states where the Democrats have been doing relatively well. States that are basically red is not going to change very much. But if all of a sudden a state like Virginia changes, Republicans are going to look at Arizona and Georgia and say, we can win back what we've lost there.
Mm. I want to play a piece of tape which sort of raises the idea, you know, are we making too much of this one governor's race? Here's Stephen Farnsworth. He's a professor of political science at the University of Mary Washington in Virginia. He says we might be overanalyzing just a little too much the importance of this particular race.
In all honesty, I don't think that that people should draw as much as they do from these contests. The reality is that any election a year ahead of another election doesn't take account of what might happen next. If we had been thinking about the 2020 election in at various points along the way, certainly a year in advance, before there was COVID, we wouldn't have anticipated the 2020 year that came to pass.
So let me ask you both about that and get you to respond to it. Mel, I'll start with you. I mean, obviously, we think this race is important. I think this race is important. We wouldn't be spending the last hour talking about it if we didn't. But this is just a little check and just to say, you know, people like us spend a lot of time thinking, talking, wondering about politics. This is clearly the biggest race of the year. Do you think we're making too much of it?
I mean, maybe as a sign of what could come in the midterms, but I think certainly for the 8.5 million people that live in Virginia, you know, who wins this election could be really decisive. Democrats worked really hard to take control of both of the chambers in the legislature. Democrats now control both the House and the Senate and the governor's mansion. I think if the Republican Glenn Youngkin wins, those wins in the legislature won't mean a lot anymore. And I think that would bring about a really big shift in terms of policy in the state and the kind of gridlock that we could see with split power like that.
Clearly means a lot for the 8.5 million Virginian. But Bob, what do you think of Stephen Farnsworth's point, the idea that are we overanalyzing it as bringing some kind of message about national import?
He's technically correct in this way, that politics can change overnight based on issues that arise that we hadn't foreseen. And so that's always the case, and it could well occur and may probably occur between November 21 and November 22. But when you think about how the parties are going to look at this race, what it's going to do to their messaging, what it's going to say about Joe Biden's popularity, what is going to say about what is appealing to independents? And in particular, is it going to say that the Trump hangover in many states is, you know, is it still evident or has it really gone away? That is going to be a message that's going to be taken away nationally. And it's hard for me to imagine that that won't have an impact going forward.
And Bob, you said something earlier in the show that I'd love you to expand on a little bit, that Youngkin represents this interesting model for Republicans running for governor in a state, in states that are blue or tending blue. And so you mentioned, for example, Governor Charlie Baker of Massachusetts, from where I'm talking to you. Larry Hogan of Maryland is another one. Phil Scott of Vermont. They've been successful by distancing themselves outright from the Trump wing of the Republican Party. Youngkin is doing something else here that might be a different kind of model, right?
Exactly. And part of that is because of the Virginia Republican Party. The Virginia Republican Party, in terms of its base, is really still a Trump party in many ways, particularly in the rural base and the places where Republicans do best. And so unlike you know, these three Republican governors in three of the bluest states and also three of the six most highly educated states in the country who've simply distanced themselves from Trump. You know, Youngkin hasn't done that. He's walked this tightrope.
Yep.
And if he's successful, that's going to be seen as a model for other Republican governors who have to appeal to suburbanites, but at the same time live in states where there's a large number of Trump supporters in the Republican Party that they simply can't abandon. So whether that message works or whether we find out that at the end, you know, it's too much of a balancing act and that ultimately Youngkin falls off that tightrope is going to be something we'll be talking about on Wednesday and Thursday morning and for some time to come.
Really interesting. We only have seconds remaining. You may not be comfortable doing this. Predictions. Mel, do you have a prediction for Tuesday?
I'll take one to weigh in.
How about you, Bob?
You know, just I would say very, very quickly, you have different perspectives. The polls say one thing, say it's going to be very close with Youngkin having the momentum. The betting markets are still on McAuliffe. And we got another right. group of people, what I call the newbies or the kids, these modelers, these election modelers. And almost all of them have a 2-point lead for McAuliffe.
Really interesting. Bob right. Holsworth, Mel Leonor, thank you so much for helping us talk about the Virginia governor's race coming up this Tuesday. Listeners, you can continue this conversation. You can get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.